This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehias Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
We've just come out of an El Nino, and an El Nino in Africa, in Southern Africa, means drought. In East Africa, it means floods, and usually in November, December. So that's our short rains. In East Africa, we get huge floods during that time, during an El Nino. But now we're going into La Nina.
That's David Obora, chair of the Intergovernmental Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Service on the causes of Africa's extreme weather. Details coming up. Also, Burkina Faso has temporarily suspended the programs of Voice of America and BBC Africa. And the UN is urging Sudan's warring parties to de-escalate violence in the Darfur region. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. The United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Turk, is urging Sudan's warring parties to immediately de-escalate the violence in and around Al-Fashir city in northern Darfur, which has killed dozens of civilians. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
At least 43 people, including women and children, reportedly have been killed in fighting in the Sudanese city of Al-Fashir since April 14th. That was when the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces began its push to gain control of the only city in Darfur still in the hands of the rival Sudanese armed forces. United Nations Human Rights Chief Volker Turk is expressing alarm at the escalating fighting and calls for an end to the conflict, which has ravaged the country for more than a year. Speaking from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, his spokesperson, Saif Magango, warns the battle in Al-Fashir may be taking a turn for the worse.
Reports indicate that both parties have launched indiscriminate attacks using explosive weapons with wide area effects, such as mortar shells and rockets fired from fighter jets in residential districts. Since early April, the RSF has conducted several large-scale attacks on villages in western Al-Fashir, mostly inhabited by the African Zagawa ethnic community.
Magango says several Zagawa villages have been burned down. This, he says, raises the specter of further ethnically motivated violence in Darfur, including mass killings. He says civilians trapped in Al-Fashir are afraid they will be killed if they try to flee the city, home to 2 million people and 500,000 internally displaced people.
This dire situation is compounded by a severe shortage of essential supplies, as deliveries of commercial goods and humanitarian aid have been heavily constrained by the fighting, and delivery trucks are unable to freely transit through RSF-controlled territory.
High Commissioner Turk is urging both parties to the conflict and their allies to grant civilians safe passage to other areas and allow safe and unhindered humanitarian aid to reach civilians in dire need. He also is calling on the warring parties to negotiate an end to Sudan's year-long conflict, which UN agencies say has left more than 18 million people facing acute food insecurity and displaced nearly 9 million people. The RSF has not responded to VOA's repeated requests for comment on allegations about the fighting at Al-Fashir. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Burkina Faso has temporarily suspended the programs of Voice of America and BBC Africa following the broadcast of news stories about a Human Rights Watch report accusing the Burkinabe army of abuses against civilian populations. The Superior Council of Communication Thursday ordered the immediate halt of the rebroadcasts and suspension of the programs of both international radio stations for 2 weeks. Access to the websites and digital platforms of BBC, VOA, and Human Rights Watch was also suspended within Burkina Faso. In its story on the Human Rights Watch report, VOA sought reactions from several Burkinabe officials but did not receive any response. VOA will be issuing a statement in response to the Burkina Faso government's action. Military-ruled Burkina Faso has, in recent months, suspended other Western news outlets. Floods have killed at least 70 people in Kenya in recent days and more than 150 in Tanzania after weeks of heavy rains. Government officials say the floods have displaced tens of thousands of people in Kenya, Tanzania, and nearby Burundi. While East Africa is suffering under unrelenting rains, less than 3,000 kilometers to the south, Malawi, Zimbabwe, and Zambia are enduring a brutal drought that is causing widespread hunger. What is causing these two weather extremes now? David Obora, chair of the Intergovernmental Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services and founding board member of the Africa Biodiversity Alliance, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam, the weather pattern known as El Niño is part of the reason, but not the whole story.
It's very hard to say, and I study climate change impacts on coral reefs, so I certainly look at these phenomena. The thing is, because of climate change, we are ramping up the global climate system. We're adding a lot of heat to it, and it looks like that just makes the extremes even more extreme. We've just come out of an El Niño, and an El Niño in Africa, in Southern Africa, means drought. In East Africa, it means floods, and usually in November, December. So that's our short rains. In East Africa, we get huge floods during that time, during an El Niño. But now we're going into La Niña, which usually means the opposite pattern. So more rain in Southern Africa and more drought here in East Africa. But we're heading into our long rain seasons, and it's very heavy over here.
It seems like this year the weather's even worse, you know, with massive destruction because of the heavy rains in, like you said, the East Africa part. But then, you know, in South Africa, people can't grow their crops. Everything's dried up and they can't feed their families. Is there any end to this in sight? Like you mentioned, the new weather pattern is going to start soon. But is there any hope that things will change for the better?
And unless the global community starts making real decisions about climate change and driving the climate system, you know, into a new state, it won't get better. No, we've certainly noticed in Africa that climate systems are becoming, or weather systems are becoming, much less predictable. They're not as they were 20 years ago. You know, older people and communities can't provide advice anymore on when you should plant or when you should fish because things are changing. And it's very extreme this year. We can't attribute every single event to climate change. But we're certainly seeing very strong changes in patterns in not good directions. And it won't change unless we start to slow down and reverse climate change.
Is there any sign that that's happening?
Not yet. Not enough. The Paris Agreement from the UN Convention on Climate Change is commitments and pledges in the right direction. But so far, countries are not yet putting in enough investment to achieve the Paris Agreement. So it's not good enough yet. No.
Now, you mentioned La Niña is going to kick in soon. When is that going to happen exactly? And is it going to be just like you said, with the weather patterns exactly in reverse?
I think we have started into the La Niña around this time. But what it will mean for us, I can't really say. I think it's very unpredictable. I think one thing that is concerning us incredibly in those dealing with climate change is that since, I think, March last year, the ocean temperatures and also global atmospheric temperatures have been much higher than they have been in the past, and they're not showing signs of declining. And so we don't know what that will mean in the coming months with the coming seasonal patterns.
There's no way to tell.
No, I think there are climate models that can predict a little bit, but you know, we're in a big zone of uncertainty now, and that's because we're pushing without taking our foot off the accelerator with climate change.
That is David Obora, chair of the Intergovernmental Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services. He was speaking to VOA's Carol Van Dam from Mombasa, Kenya. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. For more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. Gabon's month-long national dialogue intended to lay the groundwork for restoring civilian rule in the Central African nation concludes at the end of April with delegates proposing a range of options for new governance. Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports from neighboring Cameroon that among the recommendations emerging from the dialogue are decentralizing Gabon's leadership and limiting the presidential mandate.
The more than 600 delegates attending the month-long gathering in the capital Libreville offered scores of recommendations for rebuilding the political, economic, and social organization of the Central African nation after more than 60 years of rule by the deceased President Omar Bongo and his family and months of military rule. Jean-Bernard Aseko Mvei is a cleric of the Roman Catholic Church and the dialogue's spokesperson. Speaking on Gabon's state TV on Wednesday, he said the participants were very preoccupied with why Gabon has remained poor and underdeveloped, despite the Central African state's abundance of natural and mineral wealth, fertile soils, forests, and petroleum resources.
Nous allons demander à tous les Gabonais de sortir des clivages pour regarder ensemble vers la même direction.
Vivet says the first success of the dialogue is that Gabon's citizens appear to have sunk all of their differences and are now focused on the well-being of their country. He says an April 30 plenary session will frankly examine before forwarding all the resolutions to transitional president, General Brice Oligui Nguema, who will be in charge of implementation to improve living conditions of all citizens. Emmanuel Vemba is the chairperson of Gabon's Inclusive National Dialogue Subcommission on Employment that discussed what it calls galloping youth unemployment, one factor government officials believe to be linked to mounting insecurity and highway robbery in the Central African state.
Nous avons estimé que sur les 180 000
Mba says the subcommission strongly recommends that the more than 180,000 youths who applied for jobs since the military seized power on August 30 should be recruited into public offices strictly on merit and not as a political favor, which he says has been the case since Gabon's independence about 60 years ago. He says Gabon needs 7,000 teachers, 6,000 health workers, and 20,000 police and soldiers to maintain peace in the Central African nation. Dialogue officials say strong recommendations have been made for Gabon to be a true democratic state where civilians are not persecuted for holding contrary opinions to those of the ruling governments. Other recommendations include limiting the presidential term in office to 2 5-year terms and for the central government in Libreville to reduce its overbearing influence on power through decentralization, particularly by giving more power to local officials in Gabon's 9 administrative units, known as provinces, with the possibility of electing governors. The participants say they asked Nguema to respect the transitional charter he set for himself and hand power to democratic rule by August 2025, Moki Edwin Kinzuka, VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Eighty-six states and civil society groups met this week in Oslo, Norway, to talk about the international deal to limit the use of explosive weapons in urban areas. Israel did not sign the agreement, and the issue is critical for Gaza and other war-battered areas around the world, where unexploded bombs and missiles can continue to kill long after a conflict ends. Frederico Dessi, Middle East Regional Director of the group called Humanity and Inclusion, known as HI, just returned to Jordan from Gaza a few weeks ago. He tells VOA's Carol Van Dam that large unexploded ordnances litter the streets of Gaza and many are lying under the rubble of buildings.
What I've seen in Gaza is really utter destruction, tens and hundreds of buildings flattened, and then, of course, more than a million and a half people displaced because of these offensives.
Tell me more about that. Like, you were on the ground there, and I know that it's a lot of just demolished structures. We can see that in the video, including health facilities. Are there all kinds of unexploded ordnance still laying around and people just don't know where that is?
Yes, there's a lot of unexploded ordnance. Some of them are lying above ground, in the streets, in private houses, in empty terrains, inside civilian facilities. But we estimate that most of them are actually lying under the rubble of damaged or destroyed buildings, of abandoned houses. So there is a danger now, and our explosive ordnance specialists are already working in Gaza and visiting and spotting these visible explosive ordnance and marking them with some danger signs to keep civilians and especially children away from them. But the vast majority is believed to be underground, and that will present a big challenge and a very high risk for civilians when they will be able to go back to their homes. And of course, it will pose an obstacle to any future reconstruction of these buildings.
I imagine that it's still too dangerous for your teams to go in there and try to dispose of ordnance now. I mean, with the war still raging.
Yes, it is very dangerous. First of all, because we can't bring in all the required equipment. We know that some equipment will probably be refused access by the Israeli authorities, especially as long as the war is still ongoing. Then in order to defuse safely unexploded ordnance, we need to cordon the area, keep population aside, and especially in Rafah and along the coast, the density of population is so massive that it's very hard to keep away the people, especially children. They're so curious, they have nothing to do. Schools haven't been working since October, so they're roaming the streets, they're looking at for interesting things, so they would put themselves in danger. And then also many buildings that are still standing have been damaged and might fall down if any explosive ordnance explodes in the vicinity. So we also have to be very careful how to manage that.
With the situation there, not many journalists are able to get in there. It's just so dangerous. And so I'm just wondering, we've heard about people actually starving to death. Can you describe what you saw there? Were people that hungry that they were famine conditions they were talking about not too long ago that were hitting Gaza?
Yes, it is like that, especially in northern Gaza, because most of the aid convoys in the past months that were supposed to reach North Gaza have been delayed or blocked, in many cases because of a refusal of authorization by Israeli authorities, some cases also because crowds or mobs took over the control of some of the trucks because they were desperate and they were looking for food.
That's Frederico Dessi, Humanity and Inclusion's Middle East Regional Director. He was speaking with VOA's Carol Van Dam from Amman, Jordan. Every April, the sitting U.S. president and the White House media gather to make fun of each other. The star-studded White House correspondents' dinner is a good time to analyze how a president changes his speech to his audience. Here's VOA senior Washington correspondent Caroline Prosciutti about what to expect this year in the middle of a campaign.
It's where the magnificent, with glamour and glitz, meet the mundane, with policy and politics. Journalists run the White House Correspondents' Dinner, but the real stars are the president and the comedian chosen to entertain. Sometimes the president is the comedian, like Ronald Reagan in 1986.
I've been criticized for going over the head of Congress, so what's the fuss? A lot of things go over their heads.
The April dinner makes fun of the sitting president, who responds with customized one-liners for the White House reporters and their guests. Those guests include Hollywood stars and other celebrities. Here's President Joe Biden from last year on his age.
After all, I believe in the First Amendment, not just because my good friend Jimmy Madison wrote it,
In this election year, longtime dinner guests expect President Biden to allude to his opponent. Martha Joint Kumar is a political scientist and author.
I think one of his central themes throughout his presidency has been the importance of democracy and the fragile nature of it at this particular time.
It's an American tradition for every president. But in 1981, President Ronald Reagan missed the dinner because he was recovering from an assassination attempt. Since then, every president has attended the event, except Donald Trump, who never attended during his term. Again, Kumar.
I think that just wasn't something that he was interested in doing.
Especially after 2011, when businessman Trump suffered a barrage of criticism from President Barack Obama and comedian Seth Meyers.
Donald Trump has been saying that he will run for president as a Republican, which is surprising since I just assumed he was running as a joke.
No one is happier, no one is prouder to put this birth certificate matter to rest than the Donald. And that's because he can finally get back to focusing on the issues that matter. Like, did we fake the moon landing?
Others say the slam cemented his idea to run for president, which Trump denies. Most presidents make fun of the media and then use the opportunity to praise it.
A free press is a pillar, maybe the pillar, of a free society, not the enemy.
Especially in a world where reporters could be jailed for making a joke of the president, as noted by comedian Trevor Noah 2 years ago.
You understand how amazing that is? I stood here tonight and I made fun of the president of the United States, and I'm going to be fine. I'm going to be fine, right?
The benefit of democracy and a free press are on display in Washington again this Saturday night. Carolyn Pursuti, VOA News.
And now, time for sports. I have in studio with me our VOA sports analyst intern, Omo Lemukali. And he's here to fill us in about the English Premier League race and updates with the NBA playoffs so far, along with some BAL action in the Nile Conference. Welcome to African News Tonight, Omo Lemo.
Thank you, thank you.
So what's the race in English Premier League looking like right now?
The race is looking extremely exciting. For Arsenal's sake, if you're an Arsenal fan, Arsenal right now are in the first place with 77 points. And I would not necessarily be too happy about that because Manchester City and Liverpool are right behind them. Manchester City with 76 points and Liverpool with 74 points. Now, the only reason why this is a very exciting race is because Manchester City has 33 matches played and Arsenal has 34. So with Man City's next game, if they can win, they go back up to being number one.
Tight, tight, tight race. So how about the NBA playoffs? Any updates?
Yes, yes. So for LeBron James's LA Lakers, they are down 3-0 in the series so far against the Denver Nuggets. If they lose one more, they get swept completely. And for the New York Knicks are up 2-1 against the Philadelphia 76ers. Even though Joel Embiid had 50 points, it still wasn't enough for the Philadelphia 76ers.
And lastly, Omolemo, for the BAL, how's the Nile Conference so far?
The Nile Conference is looking exciting as well, with the Egyptian Al Ahly Sporting Club in the first place. They had a pretty eventful week. They played against the City Oilers, and by sheer talent, but also a little bit of luck, they lost by 1 point, 82-81. Now, this still puts them in the first place, second place being the Libya Al Ahly Sporting Club being second, Bangui Sporting Club being third, and the City Oilers being at the bottom.
VOA sports analyst intern Omole Mokali, thank you for your input.
Thank you so much.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Douglas Mpuga, and our engineer, Patrick Deya, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.